This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. It's late June, and normally the state budget would be all wrapped up by now, but not this year. Yesterday, Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan vetoed a plan backed by State House Republicans.
I urge the legislators to meet with me as soon as possible so we can begin discussions on how we can build the kind of budget that is critical to our economic future.
Hassan especially objected to the budget's inclusion of business tax cuts, but Republican leaders had a different take on the plan. Here's House Finance Chair Neil Kirk.
This is a reasonable budget. It's substantially better than the House budget in terms of services it provides, and it maintains the principles that animate New Hampshire. We live within our means.
Meanwhile, in presidential politics, the GOP field expanded once again, with Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal becoming the 13th official candidate for his party's nomination. Jindal paid a visit to Manchester.
What we did in Louisiana is, I think, what we need to do in D.C. What we did in Louisiana is we show that we don't measure prosperity by the success of our government. We measure prosperity by how our people are doing in the real world.
And with the violence in South Carolina on the minds of many Granite Staters, an interfaith event in Concord attempted to provide some comfort and a path forward. Reverend Jed Reardon was one of the faith leaders who spoke.
I think in this day of sound bites and we need to fix it now and short memories, that we really need to be about having community conversations.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week's Roundup are Josh Rogers, senior political reporter here at NHPR. Josh, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Gary, welcome back.
Thank you.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thank you for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and Josh, I want to start with you. How significant is this governor's veto? I think Dean told us last week we haven't seen a gubernatorial veto in more than a decade.
Since 2003, when then-Governor Benson vetoed a budget crafted by an all-Republican legislature, he thought that budget spent too much money, ended up signing a budget that actually spent a little more money by the time the continuing resolution was over. And so, you know, this doesn't happen often, and it'll be interesting to see how this sorts itself out. Right now, points of compromise seem elusive. Both sides, the governor is very clear that she wants these business tax cuts, reductions in the business profits and business enterprise tax to be offset in some way, and Republicans say, you know, we're sticking by our guns and we don't want new taxes and we want these reductions and we do not want the offsets that the governor suggested thus far.
Well, and Josh, you know, when you look at just the raw numbers, there's not too much daylight between the governor's version and the legislature's version. 11.49 from the governor versus 11.35 from the legislature. So why couldn't they have worked it out given how small the dollar numbers really are?
Well, you know, the fights in budgets are often over small dollar amounts, and this is, I guess, it represents less than 1% of the overall package. But these are, you know, significant differences in priorities, and, you know, the governor says that she's concerned that the long-term effect of these business tax reductions will be blowing holes in, you know, budgets down the line and will, you know, essentially create a significant structural deficit. Republicans say this is a reasonable budget. It certainly is an improvement over what had come through the House, and that, you know, the governor ought to live with it. And that's where we are right now.
Well, and Gary and Dean, I want to hear from you, too. But while you're talking about what the governor said about these business tax cuts, let's just hear it from her.
$90 million is more than the budgets of our Department of Justice, our Department of Labor, and our Department of Agriculture combined. So what kind of choices, if they are willing to cut substance misuse treatment by a third to pay for these corporate tax rates, if they are willing to allow higher education tuition to go up in New Hampshire to pay for these corporate tax rates in this budget, if they are willing to say that we can't have adequate snow plowing in the winter because they'd rather pay for these corporate tax rates cuts, then what kind of choices would they have us make in the next biennium? And that's what's at the root of my decision to veto the budget.
Again, that's Governor Maggie Hassan speaking to reporters yesterday on her veto. And Gary Reno, so what's that $90 million she's talking about?
Well, the $90 million is if you – both of these tax reductions in the BET and the BPT, business profits tax and business enterprise tax, step down over three bienniums. So at the end of that, when they get to the low points under this bill that, or under the budget that they passed, it gets to be $90 million in revenue.
Over the next three budget cycles.
Over the next three budget cycles. So that's what she's talking about, the $90 million. And then she's saying, well, you know, if we have $21 million here, think what $90 million in cuts would mean. I mean, what we really have here, I mean, you asked about what's the difference here because the money isn't that large.
Right,
and the
raw
money
dollar
isn't
values.
Very large. I mean, we have a real difference in philosophy here. I mean, we have the Senate and the House, both in the Republicans, all saying, you know, we need to encourage business. This is the way that we get the economy going. This is how we produce jobs. And you have the governor saying the way we take care of people is we build a foundation, a safety net under them. And that's the way we keep the economy going. I mean, you know, she was saying $21 million, we could have lower tuition at the university system if they wanted to spend it on that. I mean, Senate President Chuck Morris comes back and says, well, if we do what we want to do, those graduates will have jobs and they won't need to leave New Hampshire. I mean, it's this real philosophical difference that's going to be very hard to bridge in the next 6 months.
Dean, what do you think?
It's interesting. You know, I've been watching this process up close for a while now, and in the last few weeks, there's been a tremendous amount of reading of the tea leaves about what we should read into Maggie Hassan's veto. I've heard a number of analysts say that, you know, if she was going to run for U.S. Senate against Kelly Ayotte, she should have let the budget go into law without her signature. That way she could kind of throw it back at the Republicans during the election campaign. Unlike Craig Benson, who had a ceremony to veto the budget, she did not have a ceremony. So you wonder, you know, is she losing some opportunity there to get extra visibility on a veto? In addition, you know, we have the six month extension with a continuing resolution that's going to fund at current levels, which keeps a number of entities like community colleges in limbo about whether or not they can freeze tuition. You know, she's going to have to be involved in negotiations, and some of the Republicans, like Speaker Jasper, have said not really going to get down to the nitty gritty until October. So there's a lot of question about, you know, if she were going to run, she would have tried to get out of this as quickly as possible. Others say no, you know, if she fights a good fight, that will help her in the end. So sort of the politics of it have been really interesting to watch, and some of the differences between this time and the time that Josh mentioned in 2003 with Governor Benson.
You want to jump back in there, Josh?
Well, another thing with Governor Hassan is that throughout this process, she's – before this really even got going, she laid out essentially a standard for this budget that it must be bipartisan. And, you know, it's a Republican-controlled legislature. She's in the corner office. The budget that passed during her first term when there was a split legislature was one that was, you know, a rarity in that it ultimately won broad bipartisan support. You know, that hasn't tended to be the way things go if you look at it in terms of votes. Now, there are other ways to sort of judge whether budget's bipartisan. Is it a collaborative at the committee level? Do people feel they've been heard? You know, Democrats have been grousing that they don't feel this process has been as collaborative as some of the past. You know, hard to know, but there's no doubt that Governor Hassan ran hard when she was running against Walt Havenstein on this idea that I forged a bipartisan compromise. And there's no doubt that Republicans felt, you know, somewhat raw out of that, particularly because the budget that was the bipartisan budget was largely a product of the GOP-controlled Senate. And Governor Hassan, you know, vilified the budget, you know, close – very near – right up until she embraced it with minor changes from what had been the same plan that she complained about. So, you know, I think for some time Republicans, you know, and I've been told this, have concluded that they're not simply – they're not eager to give her that, you know, cudgel in whatever race she chooses to run. And so, you know, there's some of that going on too.
Well, we've got some Facebook comments on the budget and on this idea that both you and Dean raised, Josh, as to how this plays into her possible future political aspirations. Greg posted a comment on Facebook. He says, like, sounds like she took you and I for a ride purely for senatorial aspirations. One certainly can't rely on budgetary differences as the reason for the veto. Then John and Tom both approve of the veto. Tom says lowering business taxes for large corporations demonstrably does not create jobs. And John says, I pay business taxes. I'd prefer to keep them as they are rather than cut them on the backs of the needy. Since you mentioned how Republicans have been feeling about this, Josh, let's hear from Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley commenting on the business tax cuts.
I think it's become increasingly clear that with our corporate tax rate at the 48th highest in the country, that New Hampshire's at a competitive disadvantage with other states. And so I think what we've done in terms of lowering the two business taxes, the business profits and business enterprise tax, to do it over a seven-year period is a responsible way of ensuring that we have adequate revenue from business taxes, but at the same way making New Hampshire more competitive. That's the purpose. And I think, you know, like a lot of other things in the budget, this is a priority.
Again, that's Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley talking about the business tax cuts that seem to be the biggest point of contention in this budget battle between Governor Hassan and Republican lawmakers. So, all right, Josh, so she vetoed it. Republicans say this is a good budget. So where does this all go from here?
Well, I mean, the state's going to be operating under a continuing resolution, which will, you know, fund things at the level in the current, you know, the current spending, basically, and you know, we'll see how much they get together, and it's just going to be interesting to see on if there's anything out there that will get her to potentially accept these business tax cuts. Whether, you know, it was interesting listening on the during the Senate debate, Senator David Pierce from the Upper Valley, you know, brought up the fact that, you know, Medicaid expansion, while Senate Republican leaders Chuck Morse and Jeb Bradley, you know, say that they support the continuation of Medicaid expansion, they didn't want to take it up in a budget year. You know, Senator Pierce raised the issue, and a legitimate one, that, you know, a standalone bill may face a tough road in the GOP-controlled House. And so, you know, could that lead to something? It's hard to know right now. But it's hard to see anything other than that that's potentially big enough that could get people to agree to something. I mean, I don't know. That may be far-fetched, too.
Coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about where we go from here with this sort of six-month spending plan in place. And then we'll turn our attention to presidential politics. Stay with us. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're covering some of the top stories of the week, and in a moment, we'll turn to the Affordable Care Act and how New Hampshire reacted to this week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling upholding it. Join us, as always, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. I'm here with Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, Josh Rogers, senior political reporter here at NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And gentlemen, before we turn to the Affordable Care Act, lots of reaction around the Granite State this week. I did want to just wrap up this idea, Gary, of where we're at now. So she vetoed the budget. Josh explained this sort of temporary plan that will be under. Mm-hmm. What's this plan going to look like? What does it mean for some of the folks who stood to gain in this possible budget?
There are some who gained, such as the home health care providers who would have gotten their first increase in about 6 years. They're not going to get that. The same with the substance abuse would have been expanded. The treatment and prevention programs would have been expanded. They're not going to get that. We're not going to get a 10-bed crisis unit at the Hampshire Hospital, which all the hospitals certainly have been wanting.
So that's on hold.
This is on hold. And that's probably going to be on hold for quite some time. I mean, yesterday the governor was out there saying, I want to get together with the legislative leaders as soon as possible. But the legislative leaders were saying, well, what we really want to do is we want to wait till September when the governor has to present the final figures from the 2015 budget, the unaudited figures. And that doesn't happen until September 30th. They want to take a look at that. And then Senate President Chuck Morse was raising the issue, well, we may have to really go back and revisit everything again.
Wow.
So, I mean, we're not looking at a real quick and easy solution here. We're looking at a very lengthy process.
So, Dean, some of the folks that Gary mentioned could be feeling some pain while they wait for this to shake out.
Absolutely. And it just, you know, they would probably describe themselves as being in limbo or kind of having to do a wait and see type of administration going forward. I wanted to go back briefly to an earlier political point that Josh made when he was talking about Governor Hassan's ability to kind of in the last cycle to hammer Republicans on the budget and then turn around and claim bipartisanship. And I think, you know, thinking of her as a politician in the larger context of whether or not she's going to run for Senate, I think that is essentially her skill as a politician and ability to pivot. And my guess is whatever we see this fall, she will figure out a way to kind of package it for public consumption as bipartisanship, whatever concession she has to make, even if it does turn out to be, you know, despite Republicans still kind of smarting from the last experience. I think she is good at, having watched her for a number of years, she's good at a politician at figuring out how to present it as a net win for her, for Democrats, and for the state. So I fully expect to see the same kind of pivot this time around sometime in the fall.
All right. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. If you've got questions about this whole budget debate and where the state goes from here, given that we're sort of in limbo right now, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup or catching up on some of the top stories of the week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, I did want to turn to the Affordable Care Act. Again, the U.S. Supreme Court upholding the act once again, and talk about some of the reaction here in the Granite State. And Dean, just to start with you, remind us very quickly what this case was about. There's been a lot of coverage, but just remind us.
Right. Well, the law as written says that federal subsidies will be provided to people who get insurance through exchanges, health exchanges established by the states. So it only says established by the states. Now, in reality, there are 34 states that have other either exchanges established by the federal government or, as in New Hampshire's case, a partnership with the federal government. If you read the literal wording of the law, the subsidies would only be available for people who live in places with state exchanges. So anybody who gets their health care from healthcare.gov would, in theory, lose their subsidy. So the 6-3 decision with Chief Justice John Roberts writing the majority said, you have to look at congressional intent here. And obviously, Congress did not intend to damage the healthcare system. They intended to improve it. So sort of pragmatically speaking, the intent of the law was to include everybody in all the states, even if the specific language literally says just places with state-based exchanges. So it basically opens up – it continues the subsidies for everybody instead of just people in those 16 states.
Yeah. So, Gary, bring this down to New Hampshire.
Well, in New Hampshire, we have about 45,000 people who would have been affected by this one way or another. And I mean, if it had gone the other way, it would have been devastating for the whole program, because all of a sudden these people probably aren't going to be getting insurance, or a lot of them aren't. People will be pulling out, come to the companies. We have a very competitive environment compared to the first year when we started this. We have 5 companies and 81 plans. We had 1 company and about 7 plans the first year. So, I mean, it's really been working well, but all that would have been reversed if the Supreme Court had done something else. And also, to kind of bring it a little bit to the governor, it almost kind of strengthens Hassan's hand in terms of the Medicaid expansion. I think a lot of the Republicans were kind of waiting and holding back and hoping this decision would go the other way, and they could just say, well, no more Medicaid expansion. It's can't do it because we've got to – the whole thing in New Hampshire is to use the private insurance market. And when that goes away, which would happen if this had gone the other way, then they wouldn't have had to really done much of anything to see it die.
Oh, that's an important connection, Gary, because even though, you know, on the face of it, Medicaid expansion is one separate piece of this law, the healthcare.gov exchanges, subsidies and so forth is another piece where people buy it, but they get a little help, but they're connected
they're
because
connected
of that.
In New Hampshire because the New Hampshire, the Medicaid expansion uses the private exchange for the coverage.
And if those markets collapse, there's no point in doing Medicaid expansion. Okay, important point. So on the presidential campaign trail, Josh Rogers, how were candidates talking about this? It's a big deal.
Well, you know, fight on, basically. I was with Marco Rubio yesterday, and a voter asked him a question about this in the context of judicial a judicial selection, and said, "How do we, you know, make sure we get a president who won't pick people like John Roberts and David Souter?" Was the way he put the question, and you know, Rubio said, "You know, it appears we have six people on the Supreme Court who, you know, are looking to supervise the legislature rather than, you know, interpret the law." Bobby Jindal said, "You know, and he does have a plan. One of the few." People who are promoting a repeal of Obamacare. He does have a specific plan in mind. He says, you know, this fight is only beginning. The court said one thing. Now it's our turn. I mean, there's a logic on the other side of this that says, you know, this is a good thing for Republicans because they wouldn't have to sort of reap the whirlwind of the chaos that would have ensued. But, you know, they all say that, you know, this fight continues. And, you know, some of them, Ted Cruz believes that the next election is going to be a referendum on Obamacare, which is something that a lot of people obviously said about the last election, too.
And the election before that. Yeah, I did see a Washington Post analysis, just picking up on what you said, Josh, that this decision is actually good for Republicans because, A, a lot of people in their states won't lose those subsidies and won't be left without coverage all of a sudden. And B, it gives them an issue to fight on for another day.
Indeed.
Yeah, you know, it won. And Republicans in Congress were starting to make contingency plans about what to do with people losing subsidies if this had gone the other way. So they were – I have heard a lot about this alternative interpretation that says it's actually good for Republicans. You know, the reaction on both sides of the aisle was completely predictable. You know, Republicans are going to continue to call for repeal. They're going to direct a lot of animosity towards Chief Justice Roberts. This is now the second decision in 3 years on the ACA where he has sided with the majority, and he is being compared to David Souter and Sandra Day O'Connor and even John Paul Stevens as these Republican appointees who turned out not to be true conservatives in the way that people thought. You know, we can debate whether that's fair or not, but nonetheless, I think he's cemented his place there with this decision. So, yeah, we're going to keep hearing about repeal. I don't think it's going to fundamentally change the kind of electoral narrative in any great way. We're going to hear the same kinds of conversations we heard about it. So you either like it or you don't. You either want to repeal it or keep it.
Again, the number here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love your questions, comments, thoughts on some of the big headlines of the week. 1-800-892-6477. So while we're talking about presidential candidates, there's never a shortage of people to talk about. Josh, you were covering, as you said, Bobby Jindal. Now, just remind us who he is. He's another entrant this week, the 13th official candidate.
Yes, a Louisiana governor, a guy who is sort of policy heavy in his orientation.
Known as an ideas guy, right?
Not necessarily somebody you'd consider a natural fit for New Hampshire. You know, there are a lot of people running in that category. He says, you know, the Republicans can't run, you know, have to give up any idea of being essentially a less expensive version of the Democratic Party is one thing he said yesterday. And he talked about, you know, we need to embrace the American dream versus the European nightmare that would ensue if Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders were elected. And, you know, he's a full spectrum conservative and, you know, it'll be interesting. He's got he's probably a long shot, but, you know, he was here and he said he's going to be back a bunch.
Yeah. And others that you covered this week, Gary Reno, I think, as Josh said, Marco Rubio was here. Bobby Jindal was here. Who have you been watching this week?
Well, actually, I haven't been watching many of them because
you've
been
in the legislature. But that's an honest day's work for sure. Go ahead, Gary.
But what has been interesting is the poll that just came out.
Sure.
The Suffolk University poll, which basically has Jeb Bush in the lead, and surprisingly Donald Trump in second place. But that really shouldn't be too surprising at this point in time, because we're really talking about name recognition more than anything else.
That was New Hampshire poll, though, not national.
Well, two New Hampshire polls at this point. MUR poll similar. And, it's interesting. I mean, certainly, a lot of people here have essentially derided Donald Trump's candidacy as self-promotional, and the savvy voters of New Hampshire will see through that. And, maybe that will come to pass. But right now, he's in second place, ahead of people who have spent time here campaigning. And, he's been here a few times. He does have Corey Lewandowski, who's a New Hampshire guy, at the top of his sort of campaign flow chart. It'll be interesting to see where this goes. But, there are a lot of New Hampshire Republicans, not pleased with this.
Yeah, not pleased with the fact that Donald Trump is making it towards the top. Listeners always get upset when we talk about polls. So I'm going to ask one more question, Dean. But
sure.
Some polls are better than others. And the Suffolk poll and the Granite poll from UNH that Josh mentioned have good reputations. These are New Hampshire polls, not national polls. What do you pull out of these?
Well, the argument for New Hampshire polls or Iowa polls or South Carolina polls is that's how the process functions on a state-by-state basis. You don't choose your nominees through the primary process, using any sort of national vote. So we like to look at these state-based votes. On average, Jeb Bush has been leading in New Hampshire by 4 to 5 points. This kind of reinforces it. What's interesting to me is, when we listen to kind of the national conversation among political elites, everyone is focused on, Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, and Marco Rubio. And Walker in the MUR poll is at 8% and Rubio is at 6%. A lot of people talk about Rubio having all this kind of potential energy as a candidate. He's got the highest favorability by far of any of the candidates on the Republican side in New Hampshire, but it hasn't quite happened yet. So for me, it's interesting to see, who sort of breaks into that triumvirate of Bush, Walker, and Rubio, whether it's Trump or whether it's maybe the resurrection of Chris Christie when he gets in next week. We don't know what's going to happen. It's just a very crowded field still. But even through it all, I think we're still looking to see kind of what is Walker going to do. He may get in mid-July. He's actually not in the race yet. And then obviously seeing whether Rubio can kind of build on the goodwill he seems to have among Republican voters.
Well, and you said Scott Walker not official yet, and Chris Christie not official yet.
Getting in on Tuesday, and then John Kasich. We have 13 that are official.
13 official.
Official, and then Christie's getting in next week. It sounds like Walker's going to get in mid-July, and then John Kasich is the one final individual we're waiting to see what he's going to do. So we could end up with 16 at this point.
Okay, and just to keep it balanced, how about the Democrats? How many official candidates still keeping track?
Clinton, Sanders, O'Malley, and I believe Lincoln Chafee. So
yes.
Four. The only one who's still kind of kicking around as a potential really is Jim Webb, the former senator from Virginia. He's not in the race officially. He's been spending a fair bit of time in Iowa. Joe Biden always pops in polls. There's MUR poll that came out last night, had Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire at 43 and Bernie Sanders at 35, Biden at 8, even though he's not running at the moment, and O'Malley at 2, and I think Webb was at 1. So, New Hampshire really is kind of this Clinton-Sanders dynamic for now, and we'll see if O'Malley can get any kind of traction at all here.
Well, and speaking of the Democrats, Josh Rogers, I've seen a lot of headlines about the Bernie bounce, the Sanders surge, him kind of creeping up against Hillary Clinton. But then this week, Mr. O'Malley, former Maryland Governor O'Malley, took a hit at Bernie Sanders. So what's the sort of dynamic that you're seeing on the Democratic side here in the Granite State?
Well, we'll see. Obviously, Hillary Clinton can run at a fairly stately pace at this point. Whether or not ends up working or not, we'll see. I think some people are surprised that Bernie Sanders is as high in these polls as he is. I think it was lots of Democrats I talked to before he got in the race. Not all Clinton loyalists or Sanders loyalists said essentially, you can expect anybody can get in the race is going to be above, 25, because not everyone is wild about the Clintons. But, Bernie Sanders seems to be doing all right. And, it's true that, Martin O'Malley has spent time here to no huge effect thus far. We'll see. I mean, but, we'll see if anyone is going to catch Clinton. I mean, it's like just the size of her operation, the name recognition. You know, there's certainly a possibility any campaign can kind of collapse under its own weight, but this is going to be interesting.
Yeah. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, what I think is, interesting is it's sort of this natural progression that the progressive end of the Democratic Party has never really liked the Clintons back from way back to Bill Clinton. They always thought that they were too moderate. And this is their opportunity now. Bernie Sanders fulfills their dream, really. They finally have a candidate that's out there in the progressive end of the party. And so, I mean, they're just flocking to his candidacy right now.
So it's the anybody but Hillary vote.
Basically.
Yeah.
But
go ahead, Dean.
The interesting thing is, a lot of research in political science shows that in the end, people really look for electability, or sometimes we call it viability. What's the likelihood that somebody can win in November? And you look at the polling data in both the Republican and Democratic races, and, Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton have the highest numbers. People who don't necessarily support them think they're most likely to be the nominee, or they're most likely to have a chance of winning in the fall. And I think in the end, we see this every cycle. There is this sort of shift at some point in which people start worrying about, who from my party is going to be best positioned to beat the nominee of the other party. And so in the end, for me, electability always comes out on top over ideology. And I think so you have a lot of excitement about Sanders now. But in the end, I think a lot of people are going to say Clinton has a better chance of winning as nominee of the party, and that will take precedence, I believe.
Well, not that long ago, last fall, Granite State households were bombarded with political pollsters on the phone. If you dare turn on the TV, wall-to-wall political ads. Pollsters have started to call our house again, guys. hard to believe. I haven't dared turn on the TV yet. I mean, has there been any advertising yet for this presidential primary?
Yeah, well, we saw this week that the Bush super PAC, Right to Rise, which is run by Mike Murphy, a longtime Republican operative and Bush advisor, they ran a 30-second ad for Jeb Bush in New Hampshire, basically clips from his announcement speech, the big moments from his speech. So we saw that.
Introductory.
Yeah,
ad.
Introductory. It's still pretty early. That'll obviously pick up as we get on into the fall.
All right. Well, again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Coming up, the longtime head of the state's largest labor union loses in a controversial election. We'll find out more, and let's hear from you. Stay with us. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're catching up on some of the big headlines of the week around the Granite State, and let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. On this week's Roundup, Josh Rogers, senior political reporter here at NHPR, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and Dean's Billy Yotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. And Gary, we were talking about the presidential primary a minute ago. Let's turn to another election that made news this week, and that's the AFL-CIO, the state's biggest labor union. What happened there this week?
Well, we were talking earlier about being a decade since the last veto, and it's been almost three decades since Mark McKenzie, somebody besides Mark McKenzie, has headed probably one of the more visible labor unions in the state of New Hampshire. A couple of months ago, they had an election, the state election for the AFL-CIO presidency, and McKenzie was challenged by Glenn Brackett, who is a business agent for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and familiar to a lot of people because he obviously is one of the key spokesmen for the labor problems between Fairpoint and so on and the union. And when they had the election, it looked like that Mark McKenzie won by 21 votes because they had
– Oh, that's close.
They had the ballots, about 600 of them were thrown out as being not valid because they had check marks instead of X's, which they were supposed to put in. That gave him the victory by 21 votes. If that hadn't happened, then Brackett would have won handily. So Brackett appeals it to the local board. The local board says, nah, it stands the way it is. We made the decision. We ruled these ballots. People marked them incorrectly. Well, it was an appeal to the national AFL-CIO
board. Oh, wow. Okay, so it made it all the way up to the national level.
And the national board came down this week and said, Mr. McKenzie, nice, thank you for your service, but we have a new president in the state of New Hampshire, and that's Glenn Brackett.
So does this mean anything in terms of, you know, actual policy or how labor unions will react? Or is this sort of an internal matter and the rest of us won't really notice?
Well, it's largely an internal matter, but I think it's a whole different, you know, Mark has been there forever. And I think the labor unions are not, they're not on the upswing, they're on the downswing. And I think people wanted a change. Let's see if we can do something else and get some excitement going here and get a little bit better recruitment going on.
I wonder if that has to do with the leadership, Gary, or more just that's the way the whole American economy is going.
Oh, I think it is. But I think, you know, it, like anything else, there are going to be fallouts for those sort of issues.
Again, go ahead. Sorry.
And, you know, Mark happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, if you will.
Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Well, and Dina, a sober story. New Hampshire victims of the Boston Marathon bombing were watching closely this week how the case of accused bomber Johar Tsarnaev would turn out. So just remind us what happened if people missed that
headline. Well, he was, even though we've already had the trial and we knew the outcome, he needed to formally be sentenced to death, and that's what happened in Boston. He was sentenced, and then he was flown out of New Hampshire to begin serving on I assume death row somewhere. They weren't sure if it was going to be in Indiana or some other state where they have a death row facility.
So Massachusetts doesn't have one?
Not to my knowledge, no. I mean, this was a federal crime.
Sure.
So it was interesting. Everybody's waiting to hear him speak. He hasn't really said anything thus far. There were about 3 hours of, you know, victim impact testimony from families who have been affected by this and some of the survivors who have lost limbs, et cetera. He eventually spoke quietly, did not look at the families. What was interesting is he said, you know, in case there's any question, I did this with my brother. He actually took full responsibility. He said, we did do this together, and that he was sorry. You know, not surprisingly, some of the commentary from families afterwards, they were not particularly convinced or happy or felt that it was sufficient. Still a lot, obviously a lot of animosity and hatred, et cetera, as a result of all this. But it was sort of the formal end of the process, even though it was a foregone conclusion. And now, you know, I think he's going to probably be appealing for, they say, many, many years to come.
Wow, because that's how these cases
take a look. You know, we often see someone executed and it's for a crime that may have been 15, 20 years prior.
Okay. Well, a little bit of a final chapter, at least maybe another chapter opens, Dean, as those appeals go forward. But that's the end of that Massachusetts chapter.
Right, absolutely. But yeah, it could take we may be hearing about this for a couple decades to come. Potentially.
Well, a lot of difficult news lately, gentlemen, in South Carolina. Obviously, a lot of people around the Granite State feeling for those folks after 9 folks were shot to death. And then the Tsarnaev Boston bombing story. So a lot of sober news. So I would like to turn to something a little more cheerful. And what could be more cheerful, Gary Reno, than a piping plover? This is a little long-legged shore-dwelling bird. It turns out they're endangered, but a little good news this week, they're hanging out of the seacoast.
They're not all that little, though, Maura. You
know, really?
No, they're kind of... Well, they've been around the seacoast for a while. I mean, they hadn't been here for years and years and years, and then they started showing up, and then they started having babies. And they love the dunes, the grass and the dunes and so on, and they make their nests there. And what has happened is when they had the chicks, they've had to block off sections of the beach. And this is what has caused some consternation on people's parts. They have their favorite beach spot and these birds to be protected. are taking some of the favorite beach spots.
Because you have to give them sort of a wide berth.
You have to give them a wide
them.
Berth because for the first 60 days, they do not fly. And
60 days.
60 days. So they're very vulnerable. The chicks are very vulnerable for the first 60 days.
And they're not up in a tree like most baby birds.
So
they're on the ground.
Some cat comes along. They're sitting ducks, so to speak, or sitting birds or whatever you want to
sitting
say.
Sitting clovers.
Clovers, yes. So it's but it's been, I mean, a lot of people love to go down there and see them, and they are kind of unique because there are not a lot of them around, obviously.
All right. Well, Dean, thoughts on piping plovers if you're going to go to Hampton Beach or Seabrook, I guess, is the other place.
Yeah, there's something like, I think there's six or seven nests that they're watching, and, you know, the issue here is that they're not they don't fly for 30 days, and so they're subject to being taken by predators. But, yeah, you know, there are a lot of people who love birding in the state. It's a great place to do that if that's your hobby.
Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. I want to return to our earlier conversation, gentlemen, about the budget, the governor and Republicans going back and forth on this. So, Josh, what are you going to be watching for? Is there anything to watch next week, or is this basically just kind of shut down for a little while?
Well, I, you know, it'll be interesting to see what people are talking about to the extent that they're around about, there'll be lots of sort of murmuring in the hedgerows around the State House about, like, what's going to happen next. And you know, certainly as this thing goes on, it'll be interesting to watch, you know, how the political pressure grows. You know, this is an easier position if you're, you know, a state senator. Not that many people know who you are. Not that many people necessarily, like, blame you when – you know, something doesn't happen that you were anticipating was going to happen because of the budget. And, you know, sooner or later they're going to have to come together. But it is, right now it is very unclear, how they're going to come together. And it's also it'll be interesting to watch this budget in the context of some of the other bills that are landing on the governor's desk that she's going to have to make decisions on. I mean, we didn't talk about another business tax bill that has the potential to blow holes in the budget, to use the governor's phraseology, that being a change in business taxes that was introduced at the behest of Planet Fitness. The final version of the bill is a little different than what was introduced, but you know that this would shield them from a big tax hit when they go public. Which is coming up, and that's a controversial thing. It's hard to see the governor not vetoing it based on her rhetoric thus far. This is also an issue that has been around for a while, but you know, it was sort of an 11th hour overture to the legislature, and that's going to be interesting to watch. And you know, there's some other hot button issues that are going to hit her desk, and you know, whether we get sort of spill out over those into the dynamics in the budget debate will be interesting to watch.
Well, that's a good point. I'm glad you raised that Planet Fitness tax bill. Fair or not, that's how people have labeled it. And Gary Reno, when this came back, state senators said, you know, this isn't just about Planet Fitness.
Right.
It's about everybody right. being treated when they come into, if I could put it this way, come into a whole bunch of money by going public or making some other changes. What's the prospects for this bill? As Josh mentioned, Governor Hassan and Democrats have said they have some concerns. So will this go forward or not?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I agree with Josh. I don't see how the governor doesn't veto this bill. I mean, if she's going to argue about the small decreases in business tax rates, I mean, this has got some significant implications down the road because it basically deals with closely held companies, partnerships, LLCs, when they want to go with an IPO. And how are you going to handle that?
That's an initial public offering. That's when you sort of go public on the stock exchange.
I mean, and the current law basically hits them pretty hard because the increase in the value of the company becomes part of the business profits tax liability. And this would change all that. It basically says you don't have to do that. You can make a decision. Da, da, da. And if you listen to the Democrats, it's a real giveaway because it gives it away on the front end and the back end, which means when you liquidate or cash out the company, then you don't have to make up for whatever the increase is. And it just becomes a real mess. But I think what will be really interesting next week is that the Senate Finance Committee is meeting Tuesday at 1 o'clock. And they're going to be talking about some of the impacts of the veto, quote unquote. So we'll have a forum for the Senate Finance Committee to tell everybody what they think the problems are with the veto. I'm sure we'll hear about home health care workers and providers not getting their 5%. And what we're also going to hear about is we're going to have a committee or an ad hoc committee, if you will, appointed to look at the Sununu Center because they've reduced – Sununu Center is where we have the all the problem adolescents are down at the Sununu Center. And both the House and the Senate, I think about a quarter, reduced the budget for the center about a quarter, 25%.
That's a lot,
right? It's a lot of money. And so – but there's no real plan about how they're going to go forward when they do that. And so they're going to appoint a committee to look at how are we going to do this in the future.
So at that Senate hearing, it'll give Republicans, Gary, a chance to say, hey, look at this veto and, you know, this party is suffering and that party is suffering and that party is suffering because of this veto. It's their chance to sort of make
their case.
Their case, yeah. And, do you want to jump in, Josh?
It's interesting because the governor is obviously sensitive to, you know, she's heard from people, advocates for certain policies. And, you know, when we put this to her, you know, what are you going to say to them? Those who say, you know, to quote Clyde Terry, who's, you know, been around the State House for a long time, he wrote an op-ed saying, you know, kind of like, you know, take the bird in hand rather than the two in the bush. And she said, you know, I asked them to contemplate, you know, if this is what, you know, think what you'll be getting now and think how much worse it's going to be, you know, if these taxes take effect. Now, whether or not that's true, you know, is anybody's guess. I mean, Republicans would point out that, you know, we can project, you know, costs out for various policies that the governor advocates for, you know, budgets into the future. And like they haven't done that. You know, every budget's a 2-year process and, you know, you kind of start from scratch. But, you know, as this goes, how are people going to feel about this, you know, 6 months from now if the money still isn't flowing?
6 months is a long time when you're talking about 10 hospital beds at New Hampshire Hospital mm-hmm. for people who are in the midst of a mental health crisis. Dean Spiliotis, thoughts about what you're going to be watching on this budget process? And then I definitely want to hear from you in terms of presidential politics
sure.
because, boy, it never stops.
That's right.
It's enough
and
to keep you busy.
4th of July holiday coming up. It's going to be parade time.
Right.
And lots of candidates in the state. You know, I think that we've touched on both, I think, of the key interesting things here on the budget. You know, one is the extent to which these groups are going to be able to organize in a grassroots fashion, much in the way they did after the House budget. To put pressure on legislators to restore money or to get the budget passed because there are these different –
Or to put pressure on Governor Hassan.
Yeah, Governor Hassan as well, just, you know, sort of the affected groups because that's sort of – if you're affected, the best way to do this is to exert pressure through grassroots activity. So we'll see what occurs over the next 6 months. The other issue is how they resolve the taxes issue because that is a – as I think Gary mentioned earlier in the show, that is a core sort of ideological bright line for Republicans and Democrats. And any negotiation by Governor Hassan or any sort of giving on that at all could really hurt her with progressives who are strongly opposed to business taxes. You know, as for the presidential race, you know, the most obvious interest is going to be in Governor Christie's announcement on Tuesday. He has heavily staked his chances on New Hampshire. I think he's coming here to New Hampshire directly after the announcement. So we're going to get a lot of coverage of that. And then there will be a number of candidates like Rick Perry, I think, is marching in a couple parades for the holiday. Martin O'Malley is going to be here in a week or so. Ben Carson, I think, is coming July 6th. Just a lot of activity. You know, it is a big field. So if this is something you're interested in, there's pretty much someone around every day. I think Bernie Sanders is having an event this weekend, I believe. So there's just a lot going on. So it's just fun to watch. But I think at least for the short term, Christie will get a lot of the attention around his announcement.
Although it's interesting, you know, the longer these guys wait, Dean, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like the longer they wait, you know, they come, they campaign, they talk to people, finally they announce. It almost feels anticlimactic.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about this before, the kind of the watching exploratory committees no longer be kind of the way things are done. People have these leadership packs and then they basically wait. You know, a number of governors have said, you know, we needed to wait until our budgets were taken care of. which is what's holding up Scott Walker. The Wisconsin budget is still progress. But yeah, the process has evolved now, less likely to rely on big announcements. You often announce it, as a number of candidates have, using web videos, et cetera. So it feels a little bit different than it has in previous cycles, sure.
All right. Well, keep an eye on those 4th of July parades. Gary Reno, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, Laura.
Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Josh, thank you for taking time out.
Oh, you're welcome, Laura.
Josh Rogers, senior political reporter here at NHPR. Dean, good to see you.
Sure thing. My pleasure, Laura.
Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.